We're talking about Native American women living on reservations and the alarmingly high number who experience violence. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. And we're looking closer at what the data tell us. The National Institute of Justice, it reported a few years back that 84% of American Native and Alaska Native women have experienced violence in their lifetime. Do you live on a reservation? What is your experience like? Has your family been affected by this? We're at 800-642-1234. Renee Gralowitz is a peacemaker of the Brethertown Indian Nation in Fond du Lac. She's an associate professor of anthropology and American Indian Studies at UW Oshkosh Fox City's campus. Renee, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Oh, good morning. Thank you so much for reaching out to me. I really appreciate this.
You've talked with members of tribal nations. You've heard stories upon stories from families who have missing daughters and mothers and aunts and grandmothers. What have they told you?
Well, first I need to correct your idea. We're not talking just about women on reservations. 33% of the recorded murdered Indigenous women in Wisconsin come from the Fox Valley region. And so it's not just reservation women. It's Indigenous women everywhere. And this started last year when my friend Lisa Hurst, who's Oneida, and a Native American advocate for Reach Counseling Center, she was helping me gather some data, what was going on locally for Indigenous needs. A local organization had asked me to do a presentation. Renee, what's going on with Wisconsin Nation and with Native Americans in Wisconsin? And tell us what's going on locally. What are the needs locally? And so when Lisa Hurst started her research, she has her data from domestic abuse and violence. And when she was looking for state data to affirm what's going on locally, she had a hard time finding it. And she reached out to this woman, Anita Lucchesi, and from Sovereign Bodies International. And Anita was asking all the states for their State Department of Justice data. Mm-hmm. And she was trying to match that data for the nation and compare what do the national records have. And she found vast disparity. While the national data coming out of the crime reporting said there were 6,000 missing Indigenous women, the Department of Justice data had only 116. We don't expect them to be exact, but we don't expect there to be a 90% difference between the data collection.
What accounts for that disparity?
That's what the task force is going to find out. That is the question. Because when it comes to, when we talk about reservations, we are talking about the FBI has to be, the federal has to be the data collection for any federal offenses on a reservation. But you also have county sheriffs, which usually have agreements with tribal police on investigations and very cooperative. But the databases just don't match.
And you mentioned the Fox Valley. Where are Wisconsin's Native American women disappearing? Do we see any trend lines?
Well, that's the other part of the problem, Kate. Nobody keeps the data on the missing people, and when we know somebody's missing, the police will say it's an ongoing investigation. We can't divulge. And some of these ongoing investigations have been going on for decades. There's a Native woman who's been missing in Lac des Flambeaux for over two decades. And we can't get information about what is the status of the report because it's an ongoing investigation. So we're hoping that this task force we're asking for can help us figure out how to fix these gaps in the reporting system, how to have local, county, tribal, federal, state database is connected in some meaningful fashion so we can have, we'll know really what's going on. What we have comes from Indigenous women like Anita Lucheski, Indigenous women from the National Indigenous Resource Center out from Lame Deer, Montana, that those bodies of women have started to pool data. They're my heroes. They are so my heroes, bringing this news nationwide.
We're talking about how Native women and girls go missing with Renee Gralowitz. She teaches anthropology and American Indian Studies at UW in Oshkosh, Fox City's campus. She's a peacemaker of the Brothertown Indian Nation in Fond du Lac. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are tribal members talking about this issue on your reservation? Have you seen partnerships work here? What are your questions as we look at Native women and the threats? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Renee, you've said tribal police agencies can be hesitant to respond right away if a woman is missing. What is happening there?
Well, it's very similar to what happens in cities. When somebody goes missing, the police, well, come in and they might take your report, or you go and you tell them somebody's missing. But a lot of time it is that stereotype of, oh, she's a prostitute. Oh, she's out to get drugs. Oh, she's sleeping it off somewhere. Oh, they just left. And so that stereotype of an addicted, uneducated, selfish kind of character comes out in a lot of investigations. Even on reservations, there are stories that it's powwow weekend, of course she's missing. And then 5 days, 10 days later, they find the woman's body. So it's not just dominant society, tribal misunderstanding. These stereotypes really matter in how police and agencies respond.
Are Native women being targeted?
Well, of course, from a Native perspective, we say, oh, absolutely. I've heard presentations that say Native women are easy to get, number one, because people aren't investigating. But number two, most Native women can pass as anything as on the international human trafficking. So if you want an Asian woman, oh, here, I got one. You know, she's Native American. You want a Latino, oh, here's a Latino. And so Native women can pass for a wide variety of different ethnics that might intrigue some sex trafficker. So we know that's going on at some level, but a lot of it is that it's easy to not get caught. The murder rate is frighteningly high, but the finding and solving those murder cases are frighteningly low. I don't know what those numbers are, and I am making a guess. Because it's hard to find the data on murder investigation cases that are closed and what that ratio is. I have some friends looking into that for me. But if a non-Native person on a reservation commits a federal crime, the tribe does not have the authority to arrest that person. It's a federal crime and therefore needs the FBI.
Let's pause right there with Renee Gralowitz. She's a peacemaker of the Brothertown Indian Nation. She teaches anthropology and American Indian Studies at UW Fox Valley. You can join in. Are you in law enforcement? What can you tell us about cases involving missing Native women? How is your agency responding to these cases? Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're talking about Native American women and girls who have gone missing for generations, and how federal and state lawmakers have been slow to address this. Data hard to find, as we've been learning. There's legislation here in Wisconsin that would create a task force focused on this issue, and the bill is sponsored by a bipartisan group of lawmakers, including Democratic State Senator Janet Buley.
We've got to actively look at what the circumstances circumstances are for Native women and why so many of them, to a larger proportion than the non-Native population, are being abused, abducted, or exploited.
What do you think should be done at the federal and state level to address missing Native women? Do you think a task force is the right approach? Would it build tribal relations? Join in 800-642-1234. Renee Grolowitz teaches anthropology and American Indian studies, and she stays with us. Renee, if a woman is missing or murdered, who is investigating these cases? Who takes authority here?
Well, if it's the city, then the city does. Or if it's on the reservation, the tribe does. And what we find, I don't want to say they're not doing their job. The police force, they're doing their job. They have, limited resources. Their budgets are tight across the United States. And crime rates are increasing, and violence and drugs. I mean, I understand the constraints that police forces are under. And I understand they have to prioritize their human hours and resources for investigating. I understand that. I really do. They're not doing a bad job. They're doing a good job. But the data collection is so gapped. There's just nothing really concrete for us. So what we find on a lot of places, even up here in Oneida, is that the family takes it all in charge. They know what's going on. They start putting out flyers. They make phone calls, and they get their family and friends out beating the bushes and looking. Not that different than what I've been seeing in the news in some other areas around the United States is the family and the immediate friends, they get out there and they start doing things because we want to help with the investigation. We want to help find people. So we find that a lot of immediate families will start making flyers and posters and putting them up.
Doing the legwork themselves.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's take a call. Tom joining us from Burlington. Hi, Tom.
My question is, if a person feels threatened, you can get a restraining order against another person and keep them out, keep them from coming to your home. In other words, that person can't even go any place where that person is, even temporarily. Does that apply to the to this situation? And maybe we have to have the whole thing of restraining orders and things has to be looked at.
Tom, thanks for the call. Tom is asking, do restraining orders apply here? Could they make an impact, especially in the case of Native women?
Well, I'm sure they could, because most people who are assaulted, they know who the offender is. But as what we know, a lot of this is when people go missing, they're just gone. And it might have been a friend, it might have been a neighbor, it might have been an ex-lover, but we don't, in our normal life, we don't always feel that we need a restraining order for people who we're just not happy with anymore. So I'm quite sure that restraining orders are out there and being used. I'm not familiar with the success of restraining orders at all. And I'm just not familiar with that topic.
So
can I change the subject a bit?
At first, I just want to get to the task force and understand. Yeah. You met with Wisconsin lawmakers to look at steps to address this. What came out of that meeting?
It wasn't a meeting with lawmakers. It was a meeting with Lisa and I, and we looked at, there are 7 states right now that have passed a bill. And all of those bills passed this year with a similar goal of creating a task force to look at what the problem is. We need to know what the scope of the problem is before we can start talking solutions. And we don't know what the scope is because the data doesn't match from one agency to another. And so what happened was Lisa and I looked at each other and we said, someone needs to do something. And that's when we said, well, we're going to do something. And we started writing a bill and looking at what was going on. And, Wisconsin has posted a PDF document on how to write legislation for Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. So we were looking at that and I thought, oh my golly, Iowa, email my representative, Amanda Stuck. I gave her some data, gave her a few links to look at, and I said, Representative Stuck, if you think this issue is important enough, will you please help us? And she and her staff immediately jumped on it and started running and turning our ideas into a format for Wisconsin legislation. And we met with Representative Stuck a few times to talk about our concerns and issues and trying to understand the process on how this goes, because I don't know how this all works. And now I'm finding out. And I'm so thrilled at the number of legislators who are behind this bill, who support this bill publicly, signed on as co-sponsors. I'm just moved.
And you've been working with Representative Amanda Stuck, who is a Democrat from Appleton, on this. We are discussing Wisconsin's response to Native women and girls who go missing. Renee Grolowitz is from UW-Oshkosh Fox Cities. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Renee, Minnesota's task force bill took nearly 2 years to pass, and that was a process one state over. Do you have any takeaways from how other states have done this type of legislation?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's the same topic, but when Lisa and I were first talking to tribal people and concerned organizations about what we're trying to do, every time we would go to a meeting, we would hear two or three more stories that were not listed in the data we had of missing or murdered people, not in our database. And so we're feeling the sense of urgency that this is important. But since the bill was announced on September 18th, oh my gosh, we're hearing stories of hope that here in Wisconsin, there are a few organizations that are doing this. There's an organization out of the Menominee Nation, and it's tribal supported, but it's not a tribal leadership organization. It was their women and their men and their elders that said, we're going to investigate. We're going to find out what's happening. So we're starting to hear these hopeful stories about these small organizations across the state that have been very active in this missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls and looking at issues. And wow, that gave us hope that this task force is not only going to help, you know, create some foundation of data collection, but we're also going to be able to unite these efforts so that our resources are going to be used in a more overlapping rather than competitive fashion.
Who do you envision working on this task force? What voices would be there?
I want to hear elders. I want to hear more of our elders, survivors, and not just survivors of sexual assault or domestic abuse, but survivors and thrivers who have lost family members. So the task force as a minimum will have 17 people, 10 of whom are going to be tribal, and tribal leadership, tribal police, tribal healthcare providers, as well as places like Wisconsin Indians Against Abuse, organizations like that, who have intimate knowledge working this issue with families. And that's not me. That is so not me. And I'm looking forward to looking at the constitution of that task force and the strength of that task force as they go about their job. I'm just excited. I have to wait, but I'm excited too for that day.
Renee, aside from the task force, what other steps could you see to help prevent violence in tribal communities?
I think the same steps that we need to take in preventing violence in every community. I don't know for sure, but I think poverty has a lot to do with the level of violence we see, the frustrations of daily living. I also know that alcohol and drug abuse has an awful lot to do with domestic violence and assault. Those societal ails need to be addressed in some fashion. And I'm hoping that through this task force, when they get started, we can start addressing those other variables in our society that leave people hopeless.
Renee, thank you for joining us.
I am, my pleasure. I am so thrilled that you asked me. Thank you, thank you.
Renee Gralowitz is a peacemaker of the Brothertown Indian Nation in Fond du Lac. She also teaches anthropology and American Indian Studies at UW Oshkosh Fox Cities campus. Coming up, we explore clemency as Governor Evers pardoned four convicted felons yesterday, marking the first time a governor has granted a pardon in Wisconsin since 2010. What do you think of the governor making these pardons? Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. We'll talk about it with a legal scholar right after this news update here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about clemency here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. Governor Tony Evers issued four pardons yesterday. This is our state's first pardons in 9 years. So we're looking at the pardons process, what it means. What questions do you have about the process? Are you a family member seeking clemency? In what cases do you think the governor should grant pardons? When should this not happen? Join in 800-642-1234. Mark Osler is a law professor at the University of St. Thomas in Minnesota, and he founded the Clemency Resource Center in 2015. And he advocates for sentencing and clemency policies based on principles of human dignity. And for disclosure, he has advised Brendan Dassey's legal team in pursuit of clemency. Mark, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks. It's good to be here. And it's an interesting time to be talking about this.
It is. And you have publicly supported Brendan Dassey's petition for clemency. And for background, Dassey was convicted at age 17 of helping his uncle sexually assault and murder Teresa Halbach. But his lawyers have said he was coerced into admitting to a crime he didn't commit. So why do you think this case should be considered for pardon?
Well, it is an unusual case, and this is one that's gotten a lot of national attention because of the Netflix series Making a Murder. But underneath all the dramatization of it is a really case. I say this as a former federal prosecutor, that the interrogation in this case that led to a false confession was really it was unusual. And it was just flat out bad. And that's the thing that is really compelling, is that this is a case where you have actual innocence. And even if if Brendan Dassey was guilty, you've got gross over-sentencing. And clemency has always been about the awkward cases that don't fit and can't be resolved in other ways. And this is one of them.
Governor Evers outlined standards for the pardons that he'll consider, and the governor says the person must have completed their sentence. Dassey has not completed his sentence. Do you think this petition has a shot in the face of those standards?
I do. One thing about those standards is they're rules that Evers himself created, and he has the power from the Constitution of Wisconsin to use the pardon in the way that he wishes. And so he can set aside those rules. And the other thing is that those rules on their face only apply to pardons. He could grant a commutation or a shortening of sentence to Dassey without really implicating those rules.
Yeah. And so explain that. Explain seeking a pardon versus a commutation and the difference between the two.
Yeah, they often get confused. And we call both of these things clemency, which adds to the confusion. But the conviction. A pardon is a statement by the governor saying that some of the effects of the conviction don't apply to you anymore. And in a sense, we forgive you for what you did. And a commutation of sentence doesn't do that. It doesn't affect the conviction. It only affects the sentence, and it shortens the sentence. So, for example, yesterday, what Governor Evers did was pardons. And, for example, some of the people that he pardoned wanted their gun rights back to be able to hunt, for example. And so they will get that back. when President Obama granted clemency to a large number of narcotics defendants, those were commutations. So those underlying convictions are still there. The sentences were just affected.
Well, let's look at the four pardons yesterday. What's your take on these cases? Are they good candidates, in your opinion, as you look at the profiles of these people?
Yeah, I mean, it's clear that they picked some of the best of the crop. And one commonality that we see in these four is that they were all youthful offenses when they were in their teens or in their early 20s and had time after that to show that felony was not who they were in the broader scope of their life. There's going to be more complicated cases than these four certainly coming down the pike. Now, the other thing that I thought was really remarkable about what Governor Evers did, and from the standpoint of looking at this as a form of granting human dignity to people who have been denied it in some way, he granted them and he signed them in personal meetings with the people receiving clemency. And that's something that's pretty rare, frankly, that he had them in. It sounds like they saw him sign the pardon warrant. That must have been very moving.
Oh, so they were in the same room together at that moment of the pardon.
Right. And, you know, we saw something remarkable under President Obama, which is that he wrote a letter to each of the people who received clemency, this remarkable missive from the most powerful person in the world to the least powerful person in the world, an imprisoned man or woman. But, but this personal meeting does sound like it is something that the governor chose to do, and I think it's a remarkable thing.
We're talking about pardons with law professor Mark Osler as our guide. He's a former federal prosecutor, and he advocates for clemency policies. Have you heard about the pardons Governor Evers has issued? Do you support them? What do you think should be taken into consideration when granting pardons? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Mark, pardons don't erase convictions or imply innocence, but what rights do they restore? You mentioned earlier gun rights.
Yeah, that's an important one, especially, we're both in hunting states. And yesterday we saw that one of the people who received a pardon, Mr. Nichols, what he wanted was to go hunting again. And so that's one that's important to a lot of folks. But there's other things as well. A lot of times it's occupational. And again, one of the people yesterday, Mr. Sorensen, wanted a pardon so he can serve in more positions in the military, including volunteering for deployment. And so that's another thing, is that sometimes we've got occupational restrictions that will be lifted when the pardon's received that allows that person to have the job that they want and that they're best suited for when they've proven that they are worthy of that mercy.
So they'll be able to be on a jury, to hold public office, to hold various licenses with these pardons?
That's right. And, again, that's often what's most important to people, is to be able to have those opportunities. Here in Minnesota, we have a different system where people actually make a personal plea to the governor, the attorney general, and the chief justice of the Supreme Court. And those stories, you hear the people discuss openly why it is they want their pardons. And very often it's for these reasons that they want a different job that they can't have with the felony conviction on their record.
So prior to Governor Evers, former Governor Scott Walker didn't issue any pardons during his tenure. Governor Jim Doyle issued 300. Former governors Scott McCallum and Tommy Thompson, they each issued 86. So how do Wisconsin numbers compare to other states?
They're in the middle. Historically, that there's some states that consistently have granted many more. And there's others that have, are pretty sparing with clemency. My own state of Minnesota is one of them, unfortunately. But one thing to emphasize here is that there's not a red-blue divide, that we see a lot of Republicans being pretty generous in granting pardons, including Mike Huckabee when he was governor of Arkansas, I think did over 1,000. We have Governor Robert Ehrlich in Maryland, The Republican governor in Maryland, a conservative Republican at that, who granted a lot of clemency. And so it's kind of all over the map. And it often has as much to do with process as it does with anything else.
Yeah. What about the process? How does that work on the back end that would then allow the governor to say, I want to issue a pardon?
Yeah, it's interesting because in Wisconsin, the Constitution doesn't mandate a process. It leaves it in the hands of the governor. And the pardon advisory board that this governor has impaneled, and, you know, looking at the members of that board, I think he's done a great job of assembling that board. That only goes back to Governor Lee Dreyfus in the 1980s. That it's not required. It's something that the governor can create. And I'd say the same way that Governor Evers has created, some of these restrictions or goals for pardon. It's not necessary. It's a creation of the administration. But it's a good idea.
Is granting a pardon somewhat saying, you know what, judicial branch, you made a mistake here. You overreached or your sentence was just wrong?
It can be. But it's much more often something else. For example, in the Dassey case, I think to grant clemency to Brendan Dassey would be a statement of saying there's a problem here that the appellate level hasn't been able to address, as well as making the statement that the underpinnings of this conviction are wrong. Generally, when we look at the kind of pardons that were granted yesterday in Wisconsin, the statement there is really one of mercy as much as anything else. And it's a kind of earned mercy. Now that's a little contradictory because mercy is usually freely given rather than earned, but it's a statement to these people who have not gotten in trouble again, that as a society, we're willing to come back and offer this forgiveness. And there's a balance that comes with that in the justice system as a whole that's really essential if it's going to be a moral system.
We're talking about the pardons made by Governor Tony Evers yesterday and the overarching process of clemency in Wisconsin and our country. Mark Osler is here. He's our guide. He's a law professor at University of St. Thomas. He founded the Clemency Resource Center that's housed at New York University. What do you think should be taken into consideration when granting pardons? Perhaps you think this should be left up to the judicial branch. Do you oppose pardons? Tell us why. Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email your thoughts to ideas@wpr.org. We'll get back to this conversation on pardons in just a moment. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the process of clemency in light of yesterday's four pardons by Governor Evers. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is a direct quote from the Pardon Information website. A pardon is a grant of forgiveness from Governor Evers that can restore some rights and privileges and relieve certain legal disabilities. The governor campaigned on the promise to reform the pardons board after former Governor Scott Walker disbanded it and never issued a pardon. So what do you think should be taken into consideration when granting pardons? Perhaps you think this issue should be left to the courts. Do you oppose pardons? Tell us why. 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. University of St. Thomas law professor and clemency reform advocate Mark Osler stays with us. Mark, are governors required to consider certain factors when granting pardons, or can anything go? Can they weigh whatever they want?
Again, it varies a lot from state to state, but there's some things that are almost universal when we see guidance given to governors. And one that makes sense is that the position of victims and victims' family members has to be considered. And that's part of the statute in Wisconsin. Beyond that, there's sometimes guidance that's given in state statute, and other times there's a lot of leeway given. And sometimes the governor isn't the decider. For example, in South Carolina, which grants a fairly large number of pardons every year, there's an independent board that doesn't even go through the governor that makes the decisions.
Let's bring in a call now. Doug is joining us from Maiden Rock. Hi, Doug.
Hello.
What's on your mind about pardons?
Well, I'm thinking that one person shouldn't have the ability to perform a pardon. I think it should be at least three. And I think your guest there said in Minnesota that they have recommendations from the Attorney General and the head of the Supreme Court and the governor. That way, a governor can't give a pardon to a friend or a donor to his whatever party he is running with. And I think that if you have three people giving the okay for a pardon, you're going to have more community or
group decision here. Yeah. Doug, thanks for the call. Doug is saying, you know, this should be a group decision, so there aren't any favors performed.
Well, that's always a concern. I mean, some people have had that concern, obviously, with President Trump. I think that historically, I mean, going back to the ancient roots of clemency, it has been housed in the conscience of the executive, this decision making. And there's a way in which that does make sense. For example, in Minnesota, each of the three members of the board, the Chief Justice, the Attorney General, and the governor have a veto. And that means that if one of them doesn't want to grant clemency, the whole thing grinds to a halt. And you have to be very sparing for a while. And that's not right either. And this debate goes way back. In 1788, Alexander Hamilton wrote the Federalist Papers, number 74, exactly about this, because he was promoting the idea of the Pardon Clause. And because I carry the Federalist Papers around with me, this is exactly what he said. As the sense of responsibility is always strongest, in proportion as it is undivided, it may be inferred that a single man would be most ready to attend to the force of those motives which might plead for a mitigation of the rigor of the law, and least apt to yield to considerations which are calculated to shelter a fit object of its vengeance. So, I certainly understand the caller's point. And it is good that there's a discussion and there's, advisors to the governor on this. I think that Governor Dreyfus was wise to form this advisory pardon board that now has been recreated by Governor Evers. And that does provide additional voices before the decision is made.
Let's bring in Nancy now in Ellsworth. Hi, Nancy.
Good morning. Thank you for this program. Thank you for supporting clemency. We need as a society, and especially the state of Wisconsin, to take care of our own. And that means forgiving people for past errors, especially when they've paid their dues to society.
Nancy, what is your background? I understand you're a former lawyer.
I did public interest law in Wisconsin and was heartened by the forward idea, but very distressed with the recent our recent governor, who hurt Wisconsin in so many ways, Act 10 being a primary example.
How do you think clemency can change a society, Nancy?
Having forgiveness as a basic tenet of your society is necessary for the emotional and social well-being. To know that even everybody makes mistakes and everybody does things that are injurious to others, sometimes intentionally, sometimes not. But as a society, to say we need to rehabilitate our own and to accept when people have become rehabilitated, to allow them to move forward and to be fully acting, fully participating members of the community.
Nancy, thanks so much. Mark, I suspect you're in Nancy's camp.
Yeah, I think she stated as well as anybody could that there is a really important social role for clemency. And one of them is to give people who have been convicted of a crime something to shoot for, something to hope for. And it's a motivating factor as well. If people know that if they're going to be considered for this kind of forgiveness, they can't have further blots on their record. They have to change whatever their behavior was that led them to commit that crime.
We're talking about pardons, about Governor Evers, who pardoned four convicted felons yesterday. Mark Osler has written several books on criminal law and sentencing. He's a law professor at University of St. Thomas. You can join in with your thoughts on these pardons at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Mark, let's take a look at the presidency. Pardons are also given by the president. How are those pardons different from pardons issued by a governor?
Well, they affect federal crimes, the most obvious thing. The president can only pardon or grant a commutation for federal crimes, and governors have control over the state crimes. Beyond that, it's really the same mechanism that is in play, that the president is going to review these things and make decisions based on his or her own conscience. And we've seen a wide variety of things play out with different presidents over the years.
Wisconsin's most recent governors, they handled pardons differently, as we've been talking about. What about our last two presidents? Have those have pardons been handled differently?
Yeah. And I mean, one thing that historically clemency was much more active than it has been in recent years, that even President Hoover, who people think of as being very conservative, he granted something almost 1,200 clemencies during his single term in office. And then things really tailed off beginning about the early 1980s. And, sometimes people will say there's this tradition of presidents waiting until the last minute to grant clemency. Mm-hmm. That really started with Clinton.
Oh, yeah.
And most recently, we have President Obama. He waited until the last couple of years. But once he got to those last couple of years, he did grant clemency quite a bit and really targeted it at a certain type of crime. And that is people who had been convicted of narcotics crimes and been over-sentenced for them.
Well, as you look ahead for Governor Evers, what is the timeline for future pardons? When do they come? What might the Pardons Board do next?
Well, the Pardons Board, I'm sure, has a significant backlog built up. And what I find encouraging is that it looks like there's a good likelihood that this board is going to make regular recommendations to the governor, who will make regular decisions of grants, that this won't be an end-of-the-year thing or an end-of-the-term thing. That this is going to be a regular part of his governorship. And of course, one thing that's on his plate right now is Brendan Dassey's case. And I do hope, because that case is so important, and it will give that fair consideration.
Mark, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Mark Osler is a law professor at the University of St. Thomas in Minnesota, and he's the founder of the Clemency Resource Center. You're listening to The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the Ideas Network.